the races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, about 10 minutes in, and John White standing by, and what normally would be one of my favorite weeks of the year, between Wood Memorial and Santa Anita Derby. Last, 5 years I've been at Santa Anita for Derby Week. Unfortunately, Friday afternoon, things grinding to a halt, and disappointing for everybody. John, good morning.
Certainly enjoying listening to your show in every aspect, and particularly when you get the people like Barkley Tag on. I just enjoy him so much, and I was very interested in Brendan Walsh, too, yesterday, because I'm a big Maxfield fan, and I was really glad that you were able to get the update on Maxfield. To me, this switch of the Kentucky Derby to September really is something that's very good for him, because it was very dubious whether he would able to be ready in time for the first Saturday in May, but he's got plenty of time to get ready for the first Saturday in September. And even the Florida Derby, in a way, to me, shows what Maxfield might be, because Maxfield ran Gouverneur Morris right off the track in the Breeders' Futurity, beat him by 5.5 lengths. And Tis the Law beat Gouverneur Morris by a substantial margin in the Florida Derby. So you got kind of that common opponent there, which is always tricky, but it does give you a little bit of a sense that, in fact, Maxfield, those horses that he beat, like Enforceable, how he's come out of that Breeders' Futurity and gone on and done well. So that's one of the aspects to Maxfield's performance, to me, that shows he could really be something special. And Brendan Walsh, just the way, going clear back to before last year's Breeders' Cup, and how he has continued to talk about Maxfield this spring and winter, just makes me think that he really could be something special. And but he's got to come out as a three-year-old and prove it. We see the two-year-olds that look good at two and either don't go forward, they stay the same, or even go backwards some. So it's up to him. But that's why I was listening very intently to every word Brendan was saying yesterday. And when he was saying that he feels that Maxfield's matured and that as far as his talent, he feels he's every bit as good as he was as a two-year-old and so forth. So I really liked that positive Maxfield report yesterday. And then with Barkley Tag, it's just always, I just have such a soft spot in my heart for those trainers with the type of experience of a Barkley Tag and such respect for a true horseman like he is. It, of course, funny side put him on the map, but those of us that follow racing, we've known Barkley's been just an outstanding horseman throughout his entire career. And you pointed out, look at how his owners have just stayed with him. And that's always a good sign, too, when you get these owners that are loyal to a particular trainer through thick and thin. Because one thing you learn in the horse racing game is there's plenty of thin. It's not always thick. And much more thin than thick. And so when an owner sticks with a guy through the ups and downs, it really says a lot about that particular trainer. And there's just a lot to like about Tis the Law. There's no doubt about it. I mean, his only defeat was the only time he ever ran on a wet track. And he's won in New York. He's won in Florida. You love the way he's not a go out to the front and be a pace factor type horse, that he can sit and kick the way he does. He certainly gives every indication that he can go further than a mile and an eighth. He's out of a Tisnow mare, and Tisnow ran two sensational mile and a quarter races to win back-to-back Breeders' Cup Classics. So there's just an awful lot to like about Tiz the Law. And he's in the upper echelon along with the Baffert Brigade. Baffert has said that he's got three pretty wicked amigos in Authentic, Nadal, and Charlatan, and that is certainly the case. And I'm a big Honor AP fan as well. So to me, the Baffert trio, Tiz the Law, Honor AP, and Maxfield, those are the horses to me at this particular point that I like. And as you pointed out, really we'd be sort of like in the December area for a May Kentucky Derby. So we've still got a long way to go for this year's Kentucky Derby. And needless to say, everything is so up in the air right now anyway but it's great to be able to even think about the three-year-old ranks and watch the Florida Derby and watch the Gulfstream Park Oaks and watch Zulu Alpha run in the Pan American and everything else that happened at Gulfstream last Saturday. So, and unfortunately, we had that opportunity to have horse racing as a diversion here at Santa Anita with the rug pulled out from us right at the last minute, about 33 minutes before post time, before the first race last Friday. Santa Anita told that they couldn't go forward, and it's just a shame that when in the very same state, I mean, the next door county is Orange County with Los Alamitos, and they ran last weekend, and Golden Gate is running, and even Cal Expo with the Standardbreds are running. So you got four racing venues in the state of California, and three of them are allowed to go forward, and one of them isn't, and unfortunately, I work for the one that isn't, so it puts me on the bench.
Now, and I'm glad you've stressed, how easy it is to root for Barkley Tag, who, you know, I can recall the first first awareness of certain, you know, when you start to concentrate as a player on a certain region of the country and you know certain ovals. And I, you know, being New York based and you know more or less, you know, starting as somebody playing New York, and Tag was a name that you would see ship up before Barkley came to New York full time, and it was, you know, Barkley Tag off the van. That was a big, you know, that was a big move, and then Barkley was in New York full time, and never had, you know, he never had an enormous barn. I mean, he always had, you know, exactly a number of horses that somebody has that literally wants to put his hands daily on every horse that he trains, and it really was late in his career that Barkley started to, you know, get into the hundreds in terms of starters. I mean, he would only typically have 150 starters a year for as long as I could remember. But he was always a name to respect, you know, if he was bringing a horse to New York. And then the whole funny side story and my own career is very much tied to funny side. And so, you know, to see him have this this extended success late in his career and life is amazing, and he's become so funny and self-effacing and self-deprecating. I mean, that, you know, we talked about the Youngs and you know having them as clients for 30 years, and he said, you know, for anybody to have me for 30 years says a lot. And I started to laugh. I was telling Tina after, she said, "How was the show?" I said, "Oh my God!" I said, "Barkley Tag made me laugh. He's just so it's so delightful now. This go around for him." And we've had so many fun conversations with him, you know, in the interim between now and Funny Side. I mean, he there has not been a year gone by that Barkley hasn't had a stay course.
Well, he seems more mellow heading down this Kentucky Derby trail than back with Funny Side. But what I like about him, in addition to most importantly his ability, is he's a throwback to me, to the type of trainers, sure, like a Charlie Whittingham or a Willard Proctor or those types of guys, you know. these guys that are just true horsemen through and through, and you know, just have so much experience, and they're just gems. I mean, like I say, I've always appreciated those mornings, so many mornings out at Santa Anita or Hollywood Park or Del Mar with Charlie Whittingham, and I was fortunate Charlie took a liking to me, and he was just a good guy to sit and talk to while he was even waiting for horses to work, and I clocked a lot of horses with him, and he was always the type, he would make me tell my time first. I could never, you know, I had to show my hand, and I was particularly pretty good at clocking on turf works, which are kind of tricky because you get the dogs out, and it's not as easy. It's not as cut and dry clocking works on the turf course with the dogs up that it is on the main track where you're just going by those poles that it's more clear. And those are just very special mornings to me. Rodney Rash, the late Rodney Rash, was his assistant through most of those years, and watching horses like a Flawlessly and so forth was so special. And I learned so much from the Charlie Whittinghams and the Laz Barreras and those type of guys through the years, Gary Jones, and on and on, really. But what I'm really glad about Barkley is it seems like our game, unfortunately, sometimes tends to, we tend to forget, and I say we, I mean, I don't mean me, I mean owners seem, for some reason, too often to just get amnesia in terms of what these trainers can do in terms of training horses. And I think of people like the Chief, Alan Jerkins, or even Charlie toward the end of his career, things were kind of thinner. But I mean, a Ron McAnally, that you see a guy like that for like the last 10, 15 years. I mean, Ron McAnally, as I used to say on HRTV a lot, Ron McAnally didn't just wake up one morning and forget how to train horses. And experience is it just such a critically valuable aspect of that profession. And so I'm glad when I see someone like a Barkley Tagg that is still in favor with owners to the extent that he's able to come up with a horse like a Tis the Law. So there's not only is Tis the Law a three-year-old that merits the utmost respect, but it's very easy to root for him in terms of his trainer, but also Jack Knowlton, that guy through the funny side days. I mean, he was so cooperative with the press and put such a good face on things, and you know, I've seen so many interviews with him through the years, and he's just a pleasure to listen to and to root for as well.
Well, and there, you know, there's some horses and some owners that I think about with Barkley, and one, I'll bring this up with Andy, actually, that gets forgotten about, I guess I think Tommy Volando was dead already, and it was just Mrs. Volando. But no biz like show biz. I think people forget that after Funny Side, Barkley had another three-year-old contender, you know, fairly quickly. She drove Barkley crazy.
Well, I certainly remember No Biz Like Show Biz because I ended up drafting him in November in my fantasy league, and so I was on the Derby Trail with that horse and Barkley there too. And you know, that he did well with that horse. That horse had a pretty good career, really, when you go back and look at it. So I'm glad you mentioned him. And that's part of the charm of our game is looking back. And, you know, it's one of the things I love about breeding, because when you see a dam that you go, oh, man, she was what? Look at your Hollywood Story. Now I think of you every time I see an offspring of Hollywood Story. And, of course, that comes into play right here, right now in Southern California with Honor AP. So, and we become fans of these horses. And as I've said on your show many times, too, it doesn't have to be the stake horses. Some of my favorite horses through the 60s and 70s and 80s were claiming horses that, for whatever reason, I became fans of, that they were honest, hard-knocking claiming horses that would give you an honest run. There was a mare that would run a playfair in my hometown by the name of Katie Q, And Jerry Takeda was the leading rider there. He often rode her, and she was kind of a come-from-behind sprinter. She was kind of a lesson to me early in my life that a lot of times those sprinters, when they stretch out, they don't have that same kick at the end of a race. But, you know, she was like a $1,000 claimer, a $1,250 claimer, maybe up to $1,600. But she'd run about every week. I mean, back then, that's the way those lower-level horses did. They often ran like once a week, if not every other week. And she would go six and a half, and come with that late run. And I remember betting on her to show a lot of times that, you know, because I knew the chances of her hitting the board were pretty strong. She wouldn't always win, but she would give me that run. And back then, a lot of times I might get like a 440 to show or that type of thing on her quite often. So she was just one of my favorites. And there were plenty. I had tons of them that were horses. But when you look in these pedigrees and the sire, the dam, or, you know, the sire of the sire, you know, 'tis now here in 'tis the law, like I say. How many fond memories do I have of 'tis now? I speak of my fantasy league, and Brad Free claimed him in the summer and said, I'm claiming the Breeders' Cup Classic winner. And I, at the time when Brad was claiming this cowbred, I thought to myself, I didn't say to Brad, but I thought, really? You think this cowbred is going to win the Breeders' Cup Classic? And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And then Tisnow came back and did it again the next year. So, and Jay Robbins, now there's another throwback type trainer. I got to know Jay very well. He did extremely well with a horse called Nostalgia Star, who was a multiple graded stakes winner and was a really good horse on a wet track. And Jay just did a wonderful job with that Nostalgia Star, who was kind of what you'd call a cut below the very best. You know, he wasn't in the same class as the absolute elite in Southern California. And Jay would send him out to Sportsman's Park or whatever and pick off some stakes across the country with that horse as well, Hawthorne or what have you. But Jay just did such a fantastic job with Tisnow, and especially when Tisnow was a four-year-old. He had some physical issues that Jay had to really deal with, and he just dealt with them so well. And those are just good memories. But so when I look at Tis the Law, right off the bat, I see Constitution, the sire, who sired three of the runners in the Florida Derby, and all three were considered contenders. And then you look at and Constitution, one of the hottest sires we have going now, but then you look at the bottom side of the pedigree, and you see Tis now there, and it brings back such big memories. But it also is important in terms of stamina, because you see how Tis the Law has done at the mile and an eighth in the Florida Derby, and not only winning, but winning, you know, running strongly at the end of the race. And like I say, I think he gets a lot of that stamina from Tisnow on the bottom, and that was a lesson I learned back in the Secretariat days, because if I had a dollar for every time somebody said there's no bold ruler that can win the Kentucky Derby at a mile and a quarter, I mean, I'd have all kinds of money, because that was a real popular opinion at that time, that a bold ruler just couldn't win a mile and a quarter race like the Kentucky Derby. And but Secretariat beating out of a Prince Quillo mare, Prince Quillo, one of the greatest sources of stamina that we've ever had in American breeding. And in fact, it was a Prince Quillo maternal grandsire exacta in that Kentucky Derby, as Sham was also out of a Prince Quillo mare, which is something a lot of people forget. So you had Sham running, you know, fast enough to win virtually every other Kentucky Derby, you know, and certainly up to that time he would have won every other Kentucky Derby going by raw time. But he had the misfortune to run into Secretariat, and here both of them were, their dams were by Prince Quillo. So that taught me back then, don't just be focusing on that sire and that top side. And that's extremely important, no question about it. But that bottom side, I mean, I became such a huge Stage Door Johnny broodmare fan. I mean, I can remember back in the 80s here in Southern California, and boy, when I saw Laz Barrera training somebody, or Charlie Whittingham, or these guys, and they had some horse that was out of a Stage Door Johnny mare, I just loved them, and especially as they stretched out, because it seemed like the farther they went, the better they were almost it didn't matter who the sire was, that they were going to get that stamina from stage door Johnny.
Well, and you know, it's one of the things that we'll talk to Sid tomorrow, obviously, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And the from an angle standpoint, you know, John, in fact, you're owed that same question, response opportunity about helping people, you know, learn the learning curve of picking up the game. So I'll ask you to do that. But one of the things that for me personally, you talk about broodmare sires and getting a feel for pedigree as a handicapping tool and as you know as a back of the mind nuance and that's something that fits into the the learning curve and the acquired knowledge when you start to understand bloodlines and how they impact horses that are better in the off going than those that are not, and those that are that have maybe turf aptitude and being first time turf, and there's so many different areas that can contribute to forming a good opinion. But take your turn, John, on advising people some ways to learn the game on paper and utilizing internet tools. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think one of the best things you can do to learn is read the analysis of very good handicappers that we still have in the game providing us with analysis today. That would be a Brad Free. It would be a Mike Welsh. People like that, I mean, that's kind of when they put in so much work and give you not just who they're picking, but why. And Brad comes up with some of the best tidbits. You know, he's so adept at utilizing Formulator and coming up with this and that. And Brad is always right on top of the game so much, And actually, I mean, one of the best things for a novice in our game would be to read Brad Free's book, Handicapping 101. I mean, yep. It's an absolute stellar book in terms of giving you the fundamentals of the game. I mean, it really is. He did a tremendous job on that. I was fortunate because I never did buy Tom Ainsley's book back in the 60s, but the Racing Form ran excerpts either from the book or they were separate handicapping lessons. But I've got so many forms still today from the 60s and 70s with those Ainsley lessons in there. But, it was great when you'd be sitting at the track between races. And this is where I became a fan of reading. I'll tell you, a great education for me. And another one I would definitely tell any of your listeners, any old American racing manual you could pick up from the 50s, 60s, and especially the 60s into the early 70s, but mainly the 60s, because that's where the Charles Hatton, you can go to the University of Hatton. And not only was he just a phenomenal writer in terms of his prose, but his knowledge of the game was just so incredible from a handicapping standpoint, from a breeding standpoint, from a physical standpoint. I mean, I have a whole folder of copies of the actual sheets that Dr. Manny Gilman measured the horses of, like Buck Passer and Damascus and Secretariat and Ruffian and all this. I've got a whole folder. I'm looking right at it near my desk. And Charles Hatton published those anatomical measurements of all those horses, and it was fascinating to see how they would compare to each other. But Hatton would be able to explain to you, what made a horse good. I actually had a nickname when I was with the Racing Form in the Northwest in the 1970s, because I started having Dr. Dale Johnson, a veterinarian, and we would go out for my column in the Racing Form, and we would measure a lot of horses. And I would talk so often about the measurement from hip to hock, because that's kind of that drive shaft from behind where a horse is pushing off. And Hatton emphasized that so much that I got the nickname. People would see me and say, "Good morning, hip to hock." So That, but there's so much information in those racing manuals, even beyond Hatton. With Hatton would review the year, and then he would give you a profile on each horse and go through the horse and go into their breeding in detail and go into their measurements. So, in other words, how they shaped up physically. And, I mean, it was just, I spent morning after morning after morning growing up with an American Racing manual at the breakfast table, and often would be reading those. And I think it stemmed from my, I remember my dad had two editions of it from the 50s, and I never did learn how to swim. So when we would go to the lake in the Spokane area, that's a popular thing for people to do, to go out to the lake. And since I didn't swim, that wasn't a big deal to me. So often I would sit on the beach with an American Racing manual, one of my dad's two. In fact, that's where I remember seeing they would publish the past performances of the horses that were on the experimental free handicap, and Silky Sullivan's past performances were in there, and that's where I saw that he had run in the 6.5 furlong race at Santa Anita and was 41 lengths behind at the first call with Bill Shoemaker riding and won that race. And years later, I would write for the Thoroughbred of California magazine a whole long story on Silky Sullivan. It's one of my favorite stories I've ever written, because it was there was just so much to his story. And I remember talking to Bill Shoemaker about that race, and Shoe said, yeah, he says, I was so far behind, really, I didn't think I could win going 6.5. And it was the first time Shoemaker had ridden Silky Sullivan. And I remember talking to Shoemaker's agent, Harry Silbert, and Silbert gave me a real good nugget for that story. Silbert was sitting in the box seat with the trainer, Reggie Cornell, and Cornell had told Silbert that his instructions were not to rush Silky Sullivan. So they come out of the gate, and like I say, Silky Sullivan, before you can even blink, he's 41 lengths off the lead. I mean, the chart caller, I know, was about to take the horse out of the race because he thought something was wrong with the horse. But my favorite part of that was when Harry Silbert and Reggie Cornell, you can envision them sitting in the box seat at Santa Anita, and they both have binoculars. Silbert told me, he says, we both had our binoculars on Silky Sullivan, and without putting the binoculars down, Reggie Cornell says, I told that kid not to rush this horse, but this is ridiculous.
It's a mile out of it.
Silky Sullivan ends up winning that race, and of course the Santa goes on to win the Santa Anita Derby, and you know, cause such a sensation coming to the Kentucky Derby. In fact, I was just recently writing about Arazi and that particular Kentucky Derby because of AP Indy, and as Joe Hirsch wrote in the American Racing Manual, that no horse had ever come to Churchill Downs to cause such a sensation as did Arazi. Then, since Silky Sullivan, he hearkened back to Silky Sullivan in the 1950s when Silky had shown up and was such a popular horse. And Tim Tam ended up winning that Derby. Tim Tam was a much, much better horse than Silky Sullivan. But Silky Sullivan, his whole career was very interesting. There were a lot of tidbits to it, and I really enjoyed writing that story. But I just picture those two guys standing up in the box seats and watching this horse that's 41 lengths behind, and the trainer saying, I told that kid not to rush the horse, but this is ridiculous.
Well, John, appreciate the chance to touch base, and I'm sorry that it doesn't look like there'll be a Santa Anita Derby Day card to work on and discuss and recap, but stay occupied, stay safe, you and Tracy, and we'll see where we are next week.
Yeah, that's like we say, we're kind of or even beyond day to day, we're kind of minute to minute now, and but you know what, I'm healthy, Tracy's healthy, and you know, knock on wood, because I feel so bad when you watch, it's just so heartbreaking to see what's going on. And that's why ever since Governor Newsom issued that stay-at-home order, I took that very, very seriously. I will say it infuriates me Only yesterday, when our mayor of Los Angeles, Garcetti, was giving his daily press briefing, and the news was showing on the other side of the screen live shots. They showed one of a whole bunch of kids out playing soccer, and then they cut away from that, and then about 5 minutes later showed a bunch of kids playing basketball. Look, I loved playing basketball. It was my next favorite thing to horse racing, probably when I was a kid. And I know it's really hard for the people to stay home and so forth. It's very hard, but it's very serious. It's obvious that that's a big key to this whole situation, is if you just hunker down and stay home and try to do your part to stop the spread of this insidious disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, John, we'll see if officials can move the L.A. County Health Department's office. Hoping for the best. John White, everybody, Post Time. John, let's take a break. Jeremy Plonk's going to join us, and some countdown to the crown. It's going to be a long countdown, but we continue to march forward. Jeremy Plonk joins us next, Andy Serling in a little bit, and Todd Pletcher back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield, the leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Pletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
It started when we were dancing. It got heavy when we got to the We're back at the races. So great.
Thanks to John White for the visit. Jeremy Plonk swings in with some countdown to the crown, and the week-to-week activity obviously is going to slow, and we've only got an Arkansas Derby that we know of in coming weeks, with the Santa Anita Derby seemingly tabled. But we still have got Louisiana and Florida aftermath, and then we'll wait for how the spring-summer schedule is augmented on the three-year-old trail. Jeremy, good morning.
Hey, Steve, thanks for the joke that you texted me this morning. I know that you probably didn't mean it as a joke, but you asked me if I'd be available around 10:40 today. I'm available until April 30th, all right? I mean, geez Louise, time is what we have right now. That is our commodity as we are locked within the four walls of our homes. So, if you want to talk for a month, we'll go a month straight. I'm all right.
Well, in fact, I think it was Anna Kendrick. I saw something very funny from her on her Twitter, where she said, I guess I can't lie to myself anymore about what I would do if I had a lot of free time, how much I would accomplish, because everybody's sort of in the same boat. I can totally identify with her comment, because it's like, you know, I look at my desk, for instance, and my ante office, and I'm like, oh my God, it's been 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks, and I every day I say, all right, I'm gonna get this work done in here and clean this up and organize this and throw this out, and it's like I haven't lifted a finger.
Well, I did that on like day two, but let me tell you, once you get it done, you're not in any great shape, because like you've still got infinity ahead of you, and so you're sitting in a clean office for infinity. It doesn't make that big of a difference, you know. The honey-do list, my wife asked me to check this well water filter in the basement on Saturday, so midway through the Gulfstream cart, I went downstairs, had a small leak, so I went to tighten it. Next thing I know, the pipe burst, and there's water flying all over the goddamn place, and we're screaming to get the plumber on the phone and get him over there, and we're mucking water out of the basement. So, I mean, you know, being productive during this time doesn't necessarily work out for you. That's what I'm trying to tell you. So maybe you don't want to rush to clean that office. Never know what it'll turn into.
I had expected to be traveling really this whole time. In essence, I was going to be gone 5 weeks, then home a week, and then gone another month. So I'm going to have to take advantage and be productive. That's all we can do. Jeremy, the result from Saturday was about as predictable as it came, really. I mean, that it was going to have to take something unusual to derail Tis the Law. And I thought he just, you know, he and Manny Franco came through in really impressive fashion.
I agree with you there. We talked about this a week ago at this time, and, you know, I mentioned that you want to take 3 to 5 on him, you know, that was price-dependent, that, you know, he missed that little bit of training time, the Derby date has moved, how cranked will he be? And we got into a good discussion about that last week, and I said it's not a knock on the horse, the connection's anything, it's a knock on the price. Do you want to take 3 to 5? I don't know if enough people, like, had that same mindset that's why he went off 7 to 5. But 7 to 5 is more than fair odds in this case, and
yeah.
I think he looked like a 6 to 5 shot to me, and I thought he'd be bet the 3 to 5. Now, I'm not someone who's going to get into my account and play a horse who's 6 to 5 to win or 7 to 5. Some people would say, well, that's great value, and you should try to make the, you know, the X percent profit off of it. But that's just not the way I play, but I get it if people are into that sort of thing. To me, it was a race where Tis the Law was either going to be best, or Governor Morris was the horse we didn't know how good he was yet, because I think the other ones we kind of knew. We knew the Fountain of Youth horses. We'd seen them enough down there. Governor Morris seemed to have more of an upside than the horses out of the Fountain of Youth to me, and he offered a great price, you know, at 6 to 1 almost, you know. So that was, you know, to me that was the play in there. But it was like a two-deep situation to me in the multi-race wagers and the way to attack the race. Because if you tried to attack an intra-race, it looked like it'd be Tisdall or one of the obvious horses. Well, it wasn't one of the obvious horses, but are you getting the Chivalry at 80-1? You know, I mean, you got to reach, you know. But we've seen this at Gulfstream in the three-year-old races and the three-year-old filly races over the last couple of years. Some of these huge bombs just, they repeatedly keep coming in underneath. So, I mean, if you're doing the stretch thing or you're doing the all, you know, let's take Tisdall with all with a couple logical contenders for third, then maybe you're working into a try that's, you know, 320-1 on the try is no sneeze. You know, that was pretty darn good. But it was a tough race to bet intra-race, I thought. And so I think the multi-race wagers were the way to kind of attack it. And you know, that's what we did in the Buzz Report. And we got a nice return on our pick five ticket, the return of $3,200 for the players who played our $18 suggested ticket on the Buzz on Saturday. Again, we went too deep in the final race with Tisdall and also Governor Morrison there. So kind of felt good going into the race, being alive to those two. We felt like you had it covered pretty well. But FT Indian certainly was a win contender in there. I just thought somebody of those two would be better than him. Turned out right.
Well, and Chivalry, you know, the horses that come out of that Florida Stallion Series, this is not a new phenomenon, and it goes, and frankly, I mean, Jacks are better, and you think about when Stanley Gold was training for Fred Bry, and you know, there's been a history.
Usually earlier in the series, though, you know, those Florida Stallion Series horses are usually, you know, by this time you expect that the big barns from New York and Kentucky have laid out their best three-year-olds by now. What was interesting to me about this series at Gulfstream this year, you know, Dale Romans did not have a major three-year-old step up. His one that was really good regressed. Chad Brown had no three-year-old step up. Kieran McLaughlin had no three-year-old really step up. Bill Mott, Shug McGahee, Kenny McPeak, Mike Maker, all these guys, none of them, you know, I mean, Romans had a maiden long shot in the Florida Derby, but none of them present in the Florida Derby, and these are like the Kentucky, New York barns you expect to have. Pletcher didn't win a three-year-old stakes for the Colts this year at Gulfstream either, you know, and that's an oddity. And so this was not a year for the big barns down in Florida, so it was kind of open season for, like you say, some of these locals, the Knicks trainee for Jacks are Better Chivalry, and coming out of that series. And we saw at the beginning of the series, of course, Safi Joseph's horse winning the Mucho Macho Man, you know, who came out of that series at age two. So
Chance it.
The New York Kentucky guys didn't bring it. I mean, that's just the bottom line. They did not bring it in Florida this year at all. Tisdall was the one who was best. I mean, he won two of the major route preps in the series, and he looked good doing both of them.
The circumstance, of course, now, Jeremy, and I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Barkley with me yesterday. Their hope is that, you know, that there's a revised schedule that is going to emerge. You know, Barkley said he would hope and would like if he could run, you know, if the Preakness was going to, you know, be in a spring slot. It doesn't appear that that's the case. Speculation continues that they'll run the Preakness after the Derby. But, you know, one of the weird dynamics of this is what the distance to me is going to, you know, what the distance options are going to be. And you know, are you looking at mile and a 16th, mile and an eighth, Indiana, Ohio type slots, or what are you going to do? You got July. You'll ideally have Haskell mile and an eighth. You assume that the Travers will be, you know, between Haskell and Derby. It's a new challenge for the horsemen, and Barkley did not seem, you know, miffed or intimidated at all. He said, I asked him specifically, you know, what do you do about distances, and he said, once you get them fit, you know, to go a certain route of ground, you're fine, and that, you know, you wouldn't have to do much else.
Yeah, I mean, you could have a little bit of mishmash between one and two turns, depending, like, if they add something at Belmont, you know, in the summer, or the Dwyer date could be, like, messed around with or something, you know, and they keep that race to, you know, I mean, potentially Naira could move to Jim Dandy to Belmont or something before Saratoga or whatever they decide to do. It's also, you know, uncertain. The only thing, like I said, I don't think there's much difference between the mile and 16th mile and an eighth kind of races. The one, two, turn things can be a little bit different, but I think that's more of a problem for speed horses, the horses who are, like, a little too geeked up, and for they go back to one turn and run like sprinters, and then can they settle going back to two? That's not the case with Tis the Law and his running style, so I don't think he would be impacted by something like that. I think he could move him around from one to two turns and not have any big issues. And again, really, that only place that would apply would be if Belmont in the summer were to kind of change their schedule around to try to fit some of these horses. It's going to be a difficult path to, you know, project out. I think the Preakness, like you mentioned, like a spring date of the Preakness, I don't think is on the table. You know, I don't, you know, I do work for the Stronic Group, but I don't have any intimate knowledge of it. But I do know this, that Infield Fest is a huge part of the Maryland culture, of the Maryland outdoor scene, of the Preakness Stakes and the probability of the Preakness Stakes. That means you're putting together an entire new concert series, you know. And like, that concert series in the spring isn't announced until after the Grammys, because a lot of the artists, if they win a Grammy, will demand more, you know, for their fees and things like that. So, like, even the Grammy Awards kind of impact the announcement of Infield Fest and how that is going to go. So there are, like, outside factors in the music. All the music industry and all the touring dates and everything like that are thrown up in the air now. So, like, you know, people that... And so that is such an important part of the Preakness. I know as, like, racing people, it might, like, turn your stomach and say, oh, God, I could care less what goes on there. But that's like 60, 80,000 people in the infield paying concert-level prices, which helps fund the Maryland Jockey Club for the entire year. You know, does it develop horse players and things like that? People can say, well, that's a short-sighted money grab or whatever you want to call it. But it is a huge part of Eastern culture, of all the college kids and the cadets from West Point who come down every year and things like that. I mean, it's everybody throughout the Eastern, you know, East Coast. A lot of Massachusetts people and Boston people come down for the Preakness. We've been in the infield, I think 8 years we were in the infield out there, and we met people from all up and down the Eastern Seaboard who come there for that event. And so it's a big deal, and I think that there are, like, I think there's concert factors and things like that that will take a lot more planning than just to say, okay, coronavirus is lifted in Maryland, the restrictions, let's put the Preakness on 5 weeks from now. I don't think that can happen without a huge financial hit to do it that way. You know, I think they would lose a ton of money doing it that way. So therefore, I think something in the fall where they could plan out, still get good weather, you know, and try to play it that way, you know. But then you're like, okay, are you getting around a potential Ravens schedule and everything else? I mean, who knows if we even have an NFL at that point, you know? I mean, all the pro sports seasons are up in jeopardy right now. So it is a difficult projection to make. But I do think that the concert schedules and things like that are a factor in when the Preakness could or would be placed. So I would hold off, like, saying, well, the Preakness is definitely going to fit the racing calendar. I don't think it has to necessarily fit the racing calendar, but that's just my personal speculation. I think it's going to fit both a racing and entertainment calendar.
Jeremy, how much should we be watching? And I had the conversation with Mike Lakow earlier about, you know, kind of a I don't want to call it a luxury. However, there is... You know, there is going to be a horse population holding over in South Florida. And, you know, for instance, I mean, these are fillies, and I don't know if there's an Oaks contender in here. However, there's a mile and a 16th maiden race for 3-year-old fillies at Gulfstream on Thursday. And, in fact, I brought up one of the horses with Kenny McPeak yesterday, En Voutante, that he's got, the Uncle Mo filly. I mean, and he did say, you know, that she's an Oaks hopeful down the road. It's so crazy that we're going to be watching races, you know, at Oaklawn here for the next month and Gulfstream in particular. We'll see what happens with the Golden Gate horses. You know, Southern California trainers, you know, ship up and run on Tapita, you know, with some of theirs. It's going to be an unusual period here of monitoring some races and some spots that, you know, normally would have, of course, been, you know, way too late for any serious spring classic hopefuls.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is kind of like your Arrowgate year, right? I mean, when he was probably the best three-year-old and you knew about him by the Travers, you know? I mean, it's kind of what you're looking at for this year. And could that mean that we haven't seen the quote-unquote Derby winner for 2020 yet? Yeah, I guess it is, you know? I mean, that they could be a horse who, you know, April, May breaks their maiden, and then June, July, August, you know, they get a stakes race or two in them, and then their fourth start in the Derby for late summer, third start for the Derby, could very well be that kind of blossom to it. You know, talk about a lot of times the three-year-olds aren't great as they get to the fall because everything is geared up to the first 5 months of the calendar, first 4 months, really, and then the Derby itself. You know, that everybody's trying to peak for that. So, you know, I mean, will those horses hold their form? Will Tis the Law be as good in September as he was in March? You know, that's a good question. Will the development of one of these Baffert buzzsaws like Charlatan or Nindal continue on a fast track? Or will they be susceptible to some sort of setback at some point in time? You know, like one of the great things about Justify was obviously it took him a long time to get to the races. And when he got to the races, he was really good. And he was really good for the short time frame that he was racing. But then, you know, would he have stayed together health-wise for another 5-6 months after that? We've seen so many times that really good horses who do a lot in a short amount of time then need a lot of time afterwards and may be on the shelf for a while. Vekoma, one we just saw, right? Vekoma wins the Bluegrass Stakes, and everybody's kind of like cringing at his action, and you're just like, man, this horse can't stay healthy like this. You know, horses just shouldn't have that kind of ugly emotion and are going to be hard on themselves. So he runs in the Derby, he gets hurt, and we don't see him again. Now it takes him almost, you know, what, 8-10 months or 11 months to get back to the races, and he's back on Saturday and looks really good again. I mean, he's a really good horse, but there are some reasons why some horses just are not going to pile up the starts and stay good for a long amount of time. So that's a factor, you know, when you stretch this Derby out all the way to the first Saturday in September. And these are factors we don't know about, you know. I mean, look, we are really... we're making educated guesses most years. This year's we're just making guesses.
Well, and they'll be, I imagine. I mean, I'm keeping my usual point tally. Utilizing the point system, and you know, typically
the 30 get you there,
right? The 30 is the number, and you know, and you just wonder how quickly, and I don't think Churchill has any, you know, agenda laid out. I mean, I don't think they can put together, you know, suggested, you know, additional point slots until they know, you know, who's open and who's going to be open when.
They'll control a little bit of the cards because they run a meet, right? That would theoretically open sometime during the reopening of racing, right? Because they have dates all the way through around the 4th of July for their meet, and then they're back, you know, the September meet obviously would be when they would run the Derby. So, you know, Churchill could do something with the Matt Wynn and races like that, maybe take the Pathé Mile and stretch it out and, you know, that kind of deal. They can take stuff that's already on their existing stakes schedule for the spring meet and make them points races. So they could control a little bit of themselves. They're at the mercy of Naira when Naira can reopen. So would it be Belmont or Saratoga? And same with New Jersey. You know, what would they do with, you know, West Virginia and Ohio, right, and some of those other races, Indiana that you had mentioned, that are typically on the calendars? Again, Indiana might be too late now. I know they've moved the date of that race around a little bit, but I don't know if the Indiana Derby would be up before the first Saturday in September. I don't know the dates there at Indiana Grand off the top of my head. But some of these races for sure would fit in that July-August time frame that we're traditionally used to seeing, and June, you know, for Belmont Park. So are we racing then? I don't know. These are weird times, you know. If you told me 2 weeks ago, do you think you'll be racing in June? I would have told you for sure. Yeah, you know, we'll be through this, and you know, we'll be on the other side of it maybe by May, and you know, and everything will be back to normal. But that's just guesswork, and that's just, you know, an optimistic American. I mean, I don't know. The late Jeff Sotman, who was my partner with Horse Player Magazine, and Tom Quigley, rest his soul. He used to have a saying: "Nobody knows nothing." And once you realize that in life, that nobody knows nothing, it becomes a lot, things make a lot more sense to you. Because when you start to trust that you think people know something that is true, reality will show that they didn't know what they were talking about more times often than not. So take the approach nobody knows nothing and see what happens. And I kind of think that's what we're looking at here. I mean, we don't know what's in front of us at this point. It's so up in the air, you know. It's just whether you're talking about what races. I mean, we're having fun with this, right? Because this is like entertainment, and it is an industry where people are making money, and there are, you know, jobs on the line. But for a lot of the listeners, I mean, we're providing some entertainment to talk about how this could impact the Triple Crown Trail and stuff. But in the grand scheme of things, it's all conjecture, and we don't know how any of this plays out. There may not be a Kentucky Derby in September. I mean, if they're talking about canceling the football season and the NFL and college football, and nobody's going back to campus in August and September and things like that, there's not going to be a Derby in September either, you know? I mean, so we'll see, you know? I mean, we want to be optimistic and hope that it goes that way, but I don't think that there's any strong feeling that we're going to get to that, you know? So for Churchill, like you said, and the reason I get to that is because you're saying, you know, Churchill's not under any stress or time frame to come up with, okay, well, here's what we're going to do for points, you know, from here out, because, I don't know. It's just words on a piece of paper. It doesn't really mean anything.
Well, and there are fixtures that you assume are going to be part of it. You know, the Iowa Derby and Oaks are July 5th on paper, mm-hmm. and then a week later the Indiana Derby and the Indiana Oaks as well.
So that is in July now. Okay, good. Yeah.
July.
That used to be a September race when it was at Hoosier, but that's gotten earlier and earlier, I think, as time's gone on.
Well, and then we'll see how you know, how Saratoga seemingly could be a blank slate, you know, you could be very creative, and we're hoping that that's the way it's going to unfold. But in the meantime,
I would love to see the Travers opening weekend at Saratoga, and then have enough space between that and the Kentucky Derby, and that be kind of like the main prep on the East Coast.
Haskell,
I think that would be wonderful. I'd like to see the. I'd love to see the Del Mar Derby move to dirt for 1 year. Keep your grade, move it to dirt for 1 year. And if that fit on the calendar, that becomes a pseudo Santa Anita Derby for the year, timing-wise. I think those are two naturals. And the Haskell's, you know, Monmouth Meet would be a blank slate too, right? I mean, they haven't started yet. They can go anywhere. So if Monmouth wants to keep the Travers off of the Haskell, they could move up 4 weeks in front of the Travers. I mean, if they're back running, I mean, let's just say we're back running in June, if that's the case. If you're back running in June, you could make a Haskell in July, the first week of July. You could make a Saratoga first week of August for the Travers, and then first week of September for the Derby, and you could hit all three of them. And that would be a fabulous schedule for fans to follow and horsemen to follow, that they could hit those kind of dates. You could hit two out of three, all three, one out of three.
Well, it's, you know, it's just fluid, and we'll see, you know, how the schedule develops, and I mean, there's so much, and there's so much that could be creative and fun, and we'll hope that's, you know, the way it's utilized. I think that's the best. I think that's the best we can hope for. How are you going to treat, Jeremy, how are you going to treat Countdown going forward here in the next few weeks?
Well, we're doing the Countdown of the top 15 three-year-olds that we've scouted in the 15 years. And so we're down. We've got two left. Last week was number three, which I had as Barbaro. So we're down to the top two, so you can make some guesses on who they may be. 2006 to the present, the 15 seasons of Countdown. So we're going to continue to do the next 2 weeks with that and count down those two since there's no races. This week we'll have the review of the Florida Derby. The written recap is part of that. And then, you know, after 2 weeks, we're probably just going to be on hiatus until the Oaklawn series kicks back up with the Arkansas Derby, and we'll come out the week before that. It's, you know, kind of, could I start looking again at the maidens and the allowances? I'll be honest, yes, you could do that, but I've got a gap because we look at them traditionally really strong in January and February, and then once the 1st of March hits, we kind of, we stop, you know, analyzing all those races close. If I start back up again, there's a big gap there of races kind of missed, and so you're kind of given like an incomplete schedule, and really, I mean, I don't know. Like, we're trying to find a horse out of the maiden or allowance ranks now for September or October or whenever the rest of the Triple Crown races might be. It's kind of sketchy. So I'm going to play the next 2 weeks and continue the countdown of the top 15 runners. We'll have the recap of the Florida Derby this week, and then we'll take a week or two off until that Arkansas Derby runs in May. Okay. So that'll get us into the second week of April. So we'll probably have 2 weeks off, 3 weeks off, and then come back for the Arkansas Derby preview and then the Arkansas Derby review after that. If there's a good race, we'll be there. That's probably the rule of thumb. But the gaps in between and things like that, there's no contractual obligation or anything to just keep cranking out content for the sake of cranking out content. So, if there's a good race, we'll cover it. That's the way I'm looking at it.
Perfect. And as you mentioned with the Buzz Report, a couple of it was such a good Saturday for a lot of opinion offers. You mentioned what you guys put out, and that included some of the races earlier in the day. That first time North America a horse that ran. I saw that you offered that one up, and
The $41 horse. Yeah, he was from Brazil. Then he ran in the 6 furlong sprint over stakes over at Tampa. You know, and I was looking at that race where I really didn't like the way Intrepid Heart had been working at all. Watching those at XBTV, and I thought they were really valuable in eliminating that. The other favorite in the race had run like once in 18 months, and it just didn't look like there was any speed in the race. And so the 6 furlong stretch out, they were throwing blinkers on him anyway. I thought the horse would be, you know, 15-ish to 1, but ended up, you know, paying $41 and going wire to wire. Sometimes, that's a handicapping lesson in that. Sometimes when there's a race where you don't have a very good feel for the main contenders, take the speed. You know, speed is dangerous in North American races. You got a lot less variables to worry about with things. And if those good horses at shorter prices don't fire, they're not catching the one in front of them, you know. And so if you're getting a race where you're not really sure what's going to happen and you're confused on it, sometimes settling on the speed. And if you've got a little bit of, you know, a little bit of feel for him, again, he ran in a quality race over at Tampa going shorter. So, took a little stab there. It wasn't one of my high confidence plays of the day, but it really worked out well and caught the double from the race prior to it. That was the one where you had the Vitology and then Clement score. So it was Decorated Hero or the one who won the Cutler Bay. That was the race leading into it. So, you know, if you like a price in a race and you're not sure what odds you're going to get, sometimes if you've got a pretty simple race on the other side of it, or looks to be pretty straightforward, take a shot with some doubles, you know, and that sort of thing like that. And we were able to get into that because really you only had to go too deep, I thought, in the Cutler Bay. Take the two favorites, the double with the horse you like in the next. And then you're sitting in a situation where you're live to a double. And I think the double was 162 or something like that for $2. You're like, okay, well, I don't even need to play the horse to win now at a long shot price, because I basically got him at 80-1 instead of 20-1. Utilizing doubles to horses you like a little bit, if there's a simple, you know, 1-2 combination on the other side of it, can be a good useful play there, because now you don't have to bet as much, right? I mean, you're getting them at 80-1, so a $5 double is, you know, $10 with those two horses versus maybe having to bet 30 or 40 on that long shot to win to get the same amount. You're assuming the risk, but again, like if you have a race like that with the Cutler Bay where you think it's only too deep, or like at the end of the card, you know, say you like the horse in the 13th and you thought it can only be Tis the Law and Governor Morris. That's the way I looked at the Florida Derby. So if you think it's like only those two there and you've got a decent price in the 13th, maybe you can take the doubles there and let it ride. You don't have to gamble and invest as much. You do assume some risk, obviously, but bet a little to make a lot. That's what we're all trying to do.
Well, Jeremy the team with the Buzz Report at horseplayernow.com, countdown to the crown, not a hiatus, but a little bit of a lull. And there you go. Hit the snooze button until Arkansas. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Hey, take care, Steve.
Stay safe. Take a quick break. Come right back. Andy Serling's going to join us and Todd Pletcher before we close out. We got about 45 on this Tuesday. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Pletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow. What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.